Well, good morning again. Nice to be with you. Has everyone had an excellent sleep?
Yes.
I did. It was lovely. Thanks for those who let me sleep in. You are very kind. I hope you've been enjoying the time that we are spending in the Exodus. I shall have been. Yesterday, we saw Pharaoh ask a question. A very good question. A question that lots of people to this day still wrestle with. His question was this. Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord. I will not let Israel go." Who is God? And why should I care about him? You know, what makes God somebody that I should be bowing the knee to? It's the question that Pharaoh was asking. It's a question that our friends ask. And today we're going to see that God gives them and he gives us and he gave Pharaoh an absolute doozy of an answer. Because today, as we kind of hit this next little section of Exodus, we are going to see that God simply cannot be tamed. Now, this bit of Exodus is the famous bit. It's the bit that you remember as a kid. It's where God sends the 10 plagues on Egypt as a punishment for their mistreatment of his people. And this would be my summary of this section of Exodus. What God does here is show people back then, show anybody who's reading on even to this day, that he can't be tamed. That we are bonkers and crazy if we think that we can somehow like put God into a box. That we're crazy to think that we can gain control over him. There are all sorts of very nice, convenient animals that we have in our lives. Anyone out there a cat person? Hands up if you love cats. Love it. Love it. Any doggo people? Oh, you are massively outgunned, cat people. Watch out. Anyone like a little bit more exotic? Like maybe you've got like a chicken or a fish or a canary or something? I don't know. You've got a meerkat. That would be cool. Yeah, yeah. Do any of you live on like the kind of semi-acreage around like the northern part of Sydney and you got like animals or something? I'm currently running a long campaign with Allison to see if I can get a sheep. Did you know there was a breed of sheep out there that are fully grown that tall? I'm working hard on this. She's maintaining our next animal needs to be a dog. I'm not convinced. But there are some animals out there, right, that have gone through the process of domestication. You know, they were once much more wild. They were once really not that much used to us. They were not particularly nice to us. But then we took them and over generations, we molded them and shaped them so that we now have more control over them. We're now in charge of them. Domestication means that an animal is now nice to us. It no longer threatens us. It's tame. I mean, my cat has spent every night of the last decade cuddled up to me. I think I've cuddled the cat for more hours than I've ever cuddled my wife. Like, this is how it works, right? There are some animals that fit into that category, but there are also other animals that don't fit that category at all. They just cannot be tamed. Not for lack of trying. People have tried to tame these different animals. They've tried to control them. They've tried to make them more safe. But it just hasn't worked. They remain more dangerous. So every night at sunset, I have to go out and I have to put my chickens away because I know that there are foxes around and I don't want to have that conversation with my three-year-old of why the chicken's head got bitten off. So I'm like, let's just put them away. Let's just keep them safe. Some animals just never get tamed. If you've ever had the joy of bringing a foreign tourist to Australia, then you have to do this. You have to go for a walk with them in the bush and warn them about the drop bears, right? And you get to chuckle to yourself and think, what an idiot. But you know still, that even though that's not true, within like 100 meter radius, there's probably like 50 things that actually could kill you. That's just the way it works here. There are things that are deadly that we have zero control over. They're untamed. And God is so much more like that. God is like so much more wolf and so much less dog, so much more lion and so much less kitty cat. God is not controllable by us. God cannot be put on a leash by us. He is powerful. He's in control of himself. He's in control of everything. We don't set the rules for him. He sets the rules for us, which is something that evidently came as a massive surprise to the Pharaoh. Now, quick recap time in case you've forgotten or you just turned up today. The Egyptians have been enslaving God's people, the Israelites, for a few hundred years by this stage. And in the last little while, they've been treating them especially badly. They've been murdering their sons. They've been working them to death. But we know, having read along to this point in the Bible, that God has had a plan for these people. God has a plan for the Israelites. He is going to use them to restore and recreate the world and redeem the world. And so he definitely has not forgotten them. He remembers them. He loves them. He says that this hardship they're experiencing this time is just like a momentary little blip. He's going to redeem them from slavery. And so he's raised up Moses. Moses is going to be his spokesperson, his messenger. He's going to come in, he's going to speak God's powerful words that are going to bring freedom, going to bring release. And that's what's happened. Moses has gone in, he's told the current Pharaoh that you've really got to let the people go. And at that point, Pharaoh laughed in Moses' face. He says, I don't give a stuff about your God. I don't care about his demands. And out of spite, and in order to kind of quash any hope they might have had, in order to make them forget God, he's decided to work them harder than ever. Now, the sum of it all, as you kind of read through to this point, is that the Egyptians and their leader, they're kind of as opposed to God as people can possibly get. They're kind of vocal, active, deliberate opposers to God. They don't care about his plans. They don't care about his claims. They don't care about his power. They don't care about his authority. They don't care about right or wrong. They just do as they please. Whatever they want, whatever feels right about the time. If that feels like it reminds you of society and leaders today, then I'm with you. This is how people work. And of course, it's because they've got their own view of God. The thing that is kind of driving this brazen opposition is that, as far as they're concerned, they are the ones who are actually in charge. I mean, for the Pharaoh, he has been told since his birth that he is a god among men. He's been told every day of his life that he can do no wrong, that he's the embodiment of perfection. He's in charge. What he decides is right. And if you're thinking of people right now who would fit that description a little bit, who think that sort of things about themselves, then I'm with you. Sydney is chock full of itty-bitty little pharaohs who are supremely confident in themselves, confident in their own ability to always be right, confident that they are the master of their own little universe. You probably know a few, or a few hundred, actually. And, scarily, if you're honest with yourself, there's a little pharaoh deep inside you too. Probably freaks you out a little bit. And it's this kind of thinking that makes the Pharaoh so bold in his opposition to God. And so what comes next is the wake-up call that he needs, the wake-up call that frankly every Pharaoh, little or small, little or big, ancient or modern, needs. It's a wake-up call about the reality of who is actually in control of everything. Because the plagues come, and they come on the people who are opposed to God. There's 10 of them all up. And as they come, God is showing that he is supreme. God is supreme. Now, I should say up front that the word supreme has been clouded in my mind for a very long time because of the pizza, right? The idea that any pizza with olives could be the greatest pizza out of all of the pizzas just does not compute with me. It just does not make sense. Because that is what supreme means, right? Supreme means that out of all the different options, this is the greatest one. This is the best one. And that is the claim that God is making about himself at this point in history. As he unleashes plague after plague after plague on Egypt, as he shows his power, as he points out how influential and how controlling he is over our world, he is saying that of all the authorities that might be out there, he is the one at the top of the tree. He says in chapter 9, verse 14, I'm going to send all my plagues against you, your officials and your people. Then you'll know that there's no one like me in all the earth. You know, there may be lots of powers out there, but God is the one at the top of the heap. He's the one at the top because he's the creator. He's the one responsible. He's the one sustaining it all. He has put order into the creation, and he can just as easily uncreate that order if he so chooses. And that is exactly what we see happen when the plagues come. God has put this order into the world. He spoke, and the chaos retreated and order came into place. And it's this kind of order that we still enjoy to this day. And we know that he is sustaining every day. That's how his role works as creator. But what God does here at this point in history in Egypt is that he starts to kind of let the order unravel a little bit. And it's in order to punish the people who have opposed him so stubbornly for so long. And so the first plague, the river of blood. Normally, the Nile is this source of life for Egypt. No Nile, no civilization. It's their only source of water. But now, God causes something that is very good to unravel a bit. It becomes disgusting. It becomes undrinkable. It becomes unworkable. It is no longer the source of life that it was supposed to be. The second plague, the frogs. Normally great. Who doesn't like having a little frog jump on their window at nighttime? But millions of them? I don't want that. You don't want that. This is disgusting. Gnats come third. And I guess, right, I'm no biologist, but I guess that gnats play some important role in the ecosystem. They've got to be feeding something. God clearly made them for a purpose. But trillions of them? You know, somehow I feel like the AeroGuard isn't quite going to cut it anymore at this point. And then there come the flies and the livestock deaths and the boils and the hail and the locusts and the darkness. And at every point of the way, God is taking something that he has made, something that normally has a purpose, something that's normally kind of ordered and controlled. And at this point, he lets it spiral out of control for a minute in order to highlight the fact that he is the supreme one. He is the one with his hands on the wheel. He uses this to punish these Egyptians who have opposed him and opposed his people for so long. And the big irony in it all is that these are supposed to have been the areas of life that the Egyptians themselves had absolute confidence in, because their gods and their pharaoh and their clever people were watching over these areas. They'd been taught that all of these things were under the control of them and their people. But God steps up and he just smashes the illusion. There are these magicians who serve Pharaoh, and they're present for the first few plagues. And everybody has thought that these guys are kind of in control, that they can do these amazing things. And somehow for the first few plagues, they manage to keep up. They can keep up with the blood thing, and they can keep up with the frogs. I don't know how they do it, but by the time they get to round three with the gnats, they have no choice but to kind of tap out, because they can't recreate it. And they tell the Pharaoh in chapter 8, verse 19, do I have this on the slides? I do. They tell the Pharaoh, what we are seeing is the finger of God. Don't you love that? These Egyptian magicians recognize that what they're seeing is like way above their skill set. They are recognizing that at this point, the real God is stepping in and it is freaking them out. God is highlighting that the Egyptian gods are not in control. You might know that the Nile River was literally worshipped as a deity. And God steps in and he ruins it on day one. The king of the Egyptian gods was the sun god Ra. And everyone thought he was so great because he was in control of the sun that brought kind of life and brought light. And so God steps in, and in the second last plague, he blots it out. He stops their god from shining down from the sky. And God makes it dead clear throughout that Pharaoh is not in control either. He may have been lifted up as being the mightiest of men, able to do whatever he pleases. But by the end of this, he is left a ruined shell. As he's seen his once mighty kingdom, the mightiest of them all at this time, reduced to a wreck, brought to its knees, begging for relief. God shows that he is supreme. Whether you're a big pharaoh or whether you're a little pharaoh, whoever you are, God needs you to know that you're not the one in control of the universe. That you sit under somebody. And through this whole thing with the plagues, God was really hammering home that this power he has, this rule that he has, it extends deeper into our lives and into our realities than perhaps we ever thought possible. As you read through the account of the plagues, there's this concept that comes up again and again and again, and it's the hardness of Pharaoh's heart. Each plague comes, and rather than relenting, rather than letting Israel go free, Pharaoh insists, no, you must stay. Even when his advisors point out in chapter 10 that the country is falling down around him, he still insists that these people are not going anywhere. There were even a couple of times with the plagues of the flies and the hail and the locusts where Pharaoh says for a minute, all right, fine, I relent, you can go. Go worship your God. Just stop the plague already. But as soon as the plague is stopped, he suddenly changes his mind. No, sorry, you're not going anywhere. I'm in control. And the reason we get given in explanation for this again and again and again is that Pharaoh's heart is hard. Something inside of him is kind of so set against God, so hardened against God, so hardened against the idea that God might be real and that God might be more supreme than the supremest guy in the land. He can't fathom that idea. And the cause of this hardness is really interesting and really important. We get told that at times Pharaoh is hardening his own heart. So in chapter 9, verse 34, it says, when Pharaoh saw that the rain, hail, and thunder had ceased, he sinned again and hardened his heart, he and his officials. So Pharaoh's heart hardened and did not let the Israelites go as the Lord had said through Moses. So Pharaoh is at times the one responsible for this attitude. He's choosing to be closed off. He's choosing to be hardened towards God. He's choosing to kind of give him the finger. But at times we also get told that God is the one making Pharaoh's heart hard. So in chapter 10, verse 20, it says, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the Israelites go. Now, God's power is clearly so much bigger and so much deeper than we can wrap our little minds around, because it's not just affecting the kind of outside world, but it also extends into you and me. And now this is probably a spot of reality that, if you're honest, makes your head spin a little bit. The idea that God can be in control over people's attitudes. And maybe it makes you question God's goodness a little bit, because, you know, if God is the one causing Pharaoh to be this rebel, how can he be then justified in punishing him for being a rebel? How is this fair? There's a few things to say. Now, the first thing to say is that the Bible is unashamed about this fact. It's not as though the authors of the Bible were stupid. They were not dummies. They didn't slip up and accidentally write that God was responsible sometimes, but that other times it was Pharaoh himself. It's not as though they didn't realize they were creating this tension. No, no, no. They knew exactly what they're doing. They're deliberately highlighting these kind of dual realities of responsibility. Because the Bible is just unashamed of these kind of hard things. It may be difficult for us to wrap our minds around God's truth when it's presented like this, but that doesn't mean it gets withheld from us. And that's because I think that as you mull this over, if you or I believed just one or the other of these kind of twin realities, it would lead us to a bad place. If you and I were led to believe that we were solely responsible for our actions, that God had no input whatsoever, then that would be a freaky thing, because then God would have been demoted a little bit. Then God would no longer be the God he claims to be. There would be this part of his creation that was beyond his reach. Now, you and I would be able to thwart God's plans. Pharaoh was here being a jerk, and it would have meant that God was powerless to stop it. That is what it would mean if we were in full control and God had no say, no input. But at the same time, the opposite is also true, and the opposite is also a freaky thing. If it was the case that you and I had zero responsibility for anything that we did, and it was all just God, then that would make us puppets, completely incapable of living, incapable of deciding, incapable of thinking, incapable of doing anything. Just actors in a play. And both extremes are clearly not right. They're clearly unhelpful in their own way. And so what we need to do is to accept this as the Bible presents it to us and grab hold of each at the same time. And kind of have ourselves hanging in the middle, being held in this tension. Even though perhaps we cannot understand how it fully works, we're just going to have to trust that God knows that this is the way reality works. That he is sovereign and we are responsible. And of course, the other really big thing that we've got to remember is that Pharaoh was the one who kickstarts it all. Now, Egypt and their Pharaoh, they set out to use and abuse Israel. Now, by this point, by the time which God is punishing them, we're at the end of hundreds of years of these people being against God. And in each of the individual plagues, we are told again and again and again, Pharaoh is still deliberately sinning. It is Pharaoh's honest choice that he does not want to change, that he does not want to submit. Now, God takes Pharaoh's attitude, and it's like he gives him the fullness of what he wants. He gives him the fullness of what he has chosen. And the way that Exodus unfolds, we see that Pharaoh begins by hardening his own heart. And particularly in the first five plagues, Pharaoh is clearly the one responsible. He sets himself up against God and says, "Nope, I'm not listening, I'm in charge." And it's as though God then, at that point, causes Pharaoh's rebellion to press on through the other plagues. That he wants to use Pharaoh as this example for all time, for all people. As a warning against what happens when you set yourself up against God. In chapter 10, verse 1, before the locusts come, it goes like this. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Go to Pharaoh, for I've hardened his heart and the hearts of his officials, so that I may do these miraculous signs of mine among them, and so that you may tell your son and grandson how severely I dealt with the Egyptians and performed miraculous signs among them, and you will know that I am Yahweh.'" God is taking this already horrible, abusive, violent, rebellious Pharaoh, and he is using him as an example of why God should not be doubted, why God should not be rejected. God cannot be tamed. He is this person we cannot control, we cannot constrain. We don't get to set the rules for him. That's what Israel was learning at this point forever for their history. However, this does not stop people trying. Now, there are oodles of people today who would just love a more family-friendly version of God to believe in. You know, they would love the G-rated God, a version of God that they suspect their friends are more likely to warm up to. And you know what they do? You know how they get it? They go on in and they edit things. And people do this all the time for all sorts of things that they like. Back when I was a kid, the movie Titanic came out. You may have seen it, you may not. It's really not that great, but it was the biggest movie of all time at that point. And people loved it. However, there is a couple of nudie-rudie bits in it. And so some people who thought that just was not right, they decided to edit it out. They literally bought the cassette tapes and like scrolled through the tape and found the sex scene and chopped it out and taped it back together and then distributed it among their churches and among their communities because they wanted people to be able to enjoy the movie without this bad bit. And there are people who have that same kind of attitude as they come to the God of the Bible. They come in and they start mentally chopping out the little bits of God that don't fit with the version of God that they would like to believe in. So they start coming up with reasons why that event could not possibly have been real, or why that author of the Bible, he must have been mistaken at this point. Or they start teaching that Jesus didn't really mean it when he said that about sin. He was just being a product of his time. That if he'd been around today, he would have been way more relaxed on this issue. Or they teach that the Apostle Paul, he majorly misrepresents Jesus. That he took this kind of peace-loving preacher named Jesus and he twisted him to this Jesus who actually cares about how we live. They do this. All in the name of making Jesus a little bit more appealing to them and their friends. They cut out all sorts of bits, including the bits that we are reading today. Because in this bit, what are we seeing? We are seeing the fact that God gets angry. That when people stand opposed to him, he won't put up with it. And that is a fact that doesn't fit with the kind of big, cuddly, all-embracing teddy bear God that they would prefer to believe in. In this bit of Exodus, we read that God is sovereign over his people, and that blows our minds, and it can confuse us a bit, and it can, for some people, make us doubt his fairness. And so that's a bit that some would say we've got to leave out. Back in 2018, a big-name minister from America, a guy named Andy Stanley, you might have heard of him. He leads one of the biggest churches in the world. He preached a sermon where he was arguing that the time has come for Christians to cut our ties with the Old Testament. You know, that we should just kind of leave it behind, that it has no place in our churches. That we need to move on from the stories and move on from the message, move on from this old, archaic way of understanding God. Because, to his mind, that's not the way of seeing God that kind of matches up with Jesus. And of course, people challenged him on it. They pointed out, well, this is actually kind of stupid. It's kind of dumb. But all he's done in the ensuing couple of years is double down on this point of view. He's insisting that this is right, that we need to leave the Old Testament behind. We need to forget about it. We need to pretend that actually it is talking about a different God. Because to his mind, there are stories and messages and ways of viewing God in it that are no longer in keeping with what is right. You know what I reckon about that? It's wrong, sure, but it is more than that. It is cruel. It's cruel. It is a cruel thing to do that, because that leaves people feeling as though God can be domesticated. It leaves people in our world thinking just like Pharaoh, that this God couldn't possibly be real, or if he is, he does not have any real say over me. He does not have any real power over me. He does not have any real authority over me. It leads to people hearing about God and just scoffing like Pharaoh and saying, God who? I don't have to care about this God. It leads to people acting like Pharaoh, thinking that there's no accountability for their actions, nobody who's ever going to hold them to account for the wrong that they do, no one who's ever going to be mad at them for it. I tell you what else it's cruel? It's cruel because it leaves people questioning the importance of the cross. Because God couldn't possibly be so mad at sin that he would need to punish someone for it, could he? We need passages like this one. It's challenging, right? But we need it to hammer home through our sometimes very thick and stubborn skulls that we should not take opposition to God lightly. That when we set ourselves up against God, he notices that. That he is the bringer of justice into this world, and we may find ourselves on the wrong side of that justice if we don't fall upon his mercy. We know from our vantage point that God has sent rescue. We're going to see it in the next session when we come to the Passover. We know that he's done it ultimately and fully and permanently through Jesus. And I'm told that when a cyclone hits, there's this one kind of safe spot, and it's the eye of the cyclone. You know, the very center, that's where you find calm, that's where you find peace, that's where you find safety when a cyclone's closing in. And I think that this is a big part of the Bible's message for us, that there is absolutely a safe spot with God. And the safest spot with God is not shoving him off to the distance, but instead it is standing right next to him. It's being so close to him through his son, the Lord Jesus, that you are putting your life in his hands, that you're recognizing that there's no longer any debt owing because it's been washed away. Safety is on offer. But in order to actually seek out that safety, you first need to know that there's a cyclone raging. In order to seek out the rescue that God provides, you need to know that there is actually a need for this rescue. Which means that it is a massive, massive, cruel mistake when people start talking about a God they'd like to tame.